Iran warns that the U.S. and Israel are plotting to create a security crisis in Syria. At least 6 people are killed in 2 separate terrorist attacks in the north and south of Iraq. And U.S. military experts visit Ukraine to enhance its air defense as tensions continue to soar in the region amid Washington-Moscow showdown over the former Russian Republic. Hello and welcome to World News from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran, where the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says the United States is seeking to rehabilitate the Daesh terror group in the region. Ali Shabkhani made the remarks in a meeting with a visiting Syrian foreign minister in Tehran. He said the United States is furious over the defeat of the terror group and is seeking to destabilize the West Asia region. Iranian official warned of a plot designed by the United States and Israel to create a security crisis in Syria. Shamkhani said any aggression and occupation will end in a humiliating defeat. For his part, the Syrian top diplomat said the illegal U.S. presence violates Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He added that Washington is seeking to create terrorist cells to harm stability in his country. Political analyst Fuad Ezzaidi has joined us with his take on visits by the Syrian foreign minister and the UAE national security advisor to Tehran. He explains how those meetings signify Iran's role in the region.
The United States is a country in decline, and a number of American allies in this part of the world are realizing it. They are realizing that the Trump administration's lack of interest in supporting its allies in this part of the world has continued, and the Biden administration is more or less following the same policy. And this is because the United States did the power in decline. The way they left Afghanistan, they ran away from Afghanistan. The way they failed in Syria and in Yemen and in Lebanon and Iraq and elsewhere is an indication that relying on the United States is not going to be a good foreign policy option. And because of that fact, UAE at least is realizing that working with Iran, having better relations with Iran is going to be their interest, because the United States is not going to be an effective power in this part of the world.
Iran's deputy foreign minister defends the 2 draft proposals Tehran has presented to the other signatories of the 2015 nuclear agreement during the recent talks in Vienna. He says the drafts are based on the documents already agreed upon by the 2 sides.
In fact, the reforms and proposals we've presented about the 2 final drafts of the 6th round of talks in Vienna were based on joint texts of the 2 sides. In other words, the texts were presented were not baseless demands or expectations. Rather, they were based on the documents agreed upon by both Iran and the P4+1 group.
Bagheri Khani made the comments in Moscow, where he held talks with Russian officials. He stressed that the 2 draft proposals are not new, rather are in compliance with the text of the previous rounds of talks in Vienna, with some amendments. He also confirmed that the Vienna talks will resume on Thursday. European signatories, including Britain, France, and Germany, have expressed dismay over Iran's proposals, saying they go against the terms of the 2015 nuclear accord. Tehran has already called on the other sides to make use of the window of opportunity, saying it will not remain open forever. And now to Iraq, where at least 6 civilians and security personnel have been killed in separate attacks. In Basra, local police say a motorcycle laden with explosives went off in the city center near a hospital and a popular market. According to officials, at least 20 people have been injured. Videos posted online show a column of black smoke rising from the site of the explosion. Separately, at least two soldiers have been killed in a bomb explosion in Wad Al Shai district in the northern province of Kirkuk. So far, there's no claim of responsibility for the attacks, but officials are pointing the finger at Daesh. The terror group has been carrying out sporadic attacks in Iraq since its defeat in 2017. Moving on to other news now this hour, turning to Yemen, where the Yemeni army says it has carried out large-scale operation against Saudi Arabia in retaliation for the kingdom's deadly assaults and continued siege. Army spokesman says a large number of drones and ballistic missiles were launched against military sites and other key locations in the Saudi cities of Abhaja, Zanasir, and the capital Riyadh. Yahya Saidi says the army also targeted Aramco oil facilities in Jeddah. He called the military sites legitimate targets of the Yemeni army and urged Saudi residents living near those areas to evacuate. This as the Saudi-led coalition has stepped up its attacks on the war-torn country in recent days. In their latest attacks, the kingdom's warplanes bombed the Sawan residential area twice in the Yemeni capital on Tuesday. Well, French police have reportedly arrested one of the suspects involved in the brutal killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. French police source says prosecutors will begin proceedings for the extradition of the suspect to Turkey. Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-based journalist and critic of the Saudi regime, was killed and then dismembered in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in October of 2018. His brutal killing drew international condemnation. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Saudi crown prince and de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman. Palestinian resistance groups say they believe that resistance is the most strategic and viable option against the Israeli occupation. In a joint statement ahead of the anniversary of the First Intifada, our popular uprising, resistance groups also condemned any normalization deal with Israel. They said all Arab nations that have normalized ties with the regime are partner in the ongoing Israeli crimes against Palestinians. They also stressed the need for support to Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails, especially those on hunger strikes. The Intifada was a sustained Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation and atrocities and erupted in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip on December the 8th, 1987. U.S. military experts have visited Ukraine to help the country develop its air defenses. Now, the visit comes amid escalating tensions between Washington and Moscow over Russia's military buildup near its western neighbor. The U.S. has recently been warning of a Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine. Russia has rejected the accusations as alarmist and an attempt to artificially stir up hysteria. However, Moscow has expressed grave concerns about any escalation in the ongoing conflict inside of Ukraine. It says NATO's buildup in Eastern Europe has encouraged Kiev to use force against the self-proclaimed republics in the Donbass region. Russia says a peaceful resolution of the conflict can only be achieved through the implementation of peace accords signed in Minsk in 2014 and 2015.
Today, there will be significant events in their relations. Phone contact, video contact between Presidents Putin and Biden. We definitely will be clearly stating our approaches to Ukrainian resolution, to the importance of making Kiev regime fulfill their written in black and white obligations under the Minsk set of measures. Apparently, Kiev won't listen to anyone except for the United States of America.
The situation surrounding Ukraine will feature extensively in a virtual meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden on Tuesday. Biden has stressed that he wouldn't accept the imposition of any Russian red lines. The U.S. has warned that it would send reinforcements to NATO's eastern flank in response to a Russian attack against Ukraine. Washington's Western allies, including the EU and the UK, have also threatened more sanctions against Russia and more military support for Ukraine. President Putin, meanwhile, has asserted that NATO's further eastward expansion is unacceptable for Moscow. He has asked for legal guarantees from the U.S.-led bloc that it would stop encroaching upon Russia's borders and refrain from deploying threatening weapons in the region.
The Russian leadership is extremely concerned about the possibility of large-scale hostilities in the eastern Ukraine, Donbas, and Crimea. There has not been such a level of military threat throughout Russia's modern history. NATO has dismissed Russia's proposal on zones of influence to somehow stabilize the situation. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has rejected a diplomatic dialogue, giving Ukraine carte blanche to withdraw from the Minsk agreements. The situation is more than ever close to a war. The United States has removed all diplomatic and political restrictions, while Ukraine's accession to the North Atlantic Alliance is a red line for Russia.
We are witnessing the expansionism of NATO led by the United States in the territories near Russian borders. That's why President Vladimir Putin is seeking legally binding security guarantees to prevent further destruction of the security system. If that does not work, our retaliatory measures will be harsh and the West will regret the missed opportunity for a deal with Russia.
Things appear to be heading toward a scenario of Russia's complete international isolation, in all-out technology and trade blockade, and an embargo on the purchase of oil and gas. To begin this plan, a military scenario might be implemented in Ukraine.
The NATO leadership understands that they have become weak and there is no unity inside. They need threats to maintain funding, and they create them by portraying Russia as an aggressor. That's why we do not hear a single word of condemnation from the West against Ukraine's escalation of violence in the East.
The Kremlin understands that passivity only makes things worse. The responsibility for the conflict will remain with Russia, and no one will be interested in the real picture.
It is unpleasant to negotiate with NATO and the US, and talks with Ukraine will not resolve anything because it is completely subordinate to Washington. Russia needs to remember one thing: the Anglo-Saxon respect only force. Russia must continue to strengthen its security and combat capabilities given the unacceptable policies of NATO and the US.
Russia demands legal guarantees since the West has not kept its promise that after the reunification of Germany, NATO would not expand eastward. Further advancement of Western forces and provocations will affect the fundamental security interests of Russia.
If Moscow's legitimate concerns about Ukraine and NATO are not taken into account, Russia will take retaliatory measures to correct the military strategic balance. An alternative to this could be long-term security guarantees on its Western borders. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Well, the U.S. diplomatic boycott of the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing is drawing an angry response from China, with its foreign ministry warning that Washington will pay a price for its mistakes.
The actions of the United States seriously violate the principle of political neutrality in sports as established by the Olympic Charter and runs counter to the more united Olympic model. It stands on the opposite side of the majority of athletes and sports enthusiasts around the world.
The ministry says Washington's plot to disrupt the international event will fail and that Beijing is prepared to take countermeasures. It warned that the decision would lead to a loss of U.S. moral authority and credibility. The State Department has said that U.S. government officials will not be attending the games because of alleged human rights violations. The decision, though, will not affect American athletes who will still compete in the games. The standoff over the Olympics is adding to a long list of disputes between China and the U.S., including trade, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and the origins of COVID. Well, we've talked to political commentator Ken Duzhu. He says the Olympics is about bringing people together and it should not be used by politicians for other purposes.
If you look at the spirit of the Olympic events, it's basically bring people together. It's about the togetherness. It's about a fair competition. It's about peace and stability. That's why we are having this sports event, to increase understanding, to forge friendship, and to compete fairly in a transparent manner. So, and you know, most of people would say that a sports event should be completely separated from politics and should not be used by politicians to sabotage to achieve their political purpose.
EU employment ministers have agreed to take measures to protect wage levels in the bloc as workers and employers are facing growing uncertainty due to economic pressures. New data shows the gap between the rich and poor in the EU is growing. Jerome Hughes brings us more from Brussels.
According to a study just published by the European Trade Union Confederation, wage inequality has grown in a majority of EU countries, 14 out of the 27 member states to be precise. The report was released to coincide with a meeting of EU employment ministers. They've agreed on a wage directive designed to protect those on low incomes.
The message coming today on the 6th of December from Brussels is a very positive, encouraging message, especially to those who are still in work poverty.
Millions of people in the EU are working in precarious jobs. Most of them are young adults.
A job well done requires adequate and just pay. This concerns the fundamental respect of people in their work. One of our priorities under the Slovenian presidency was high-quality job creation.
Although the new directive was passed here in the Council, Hungary and Denmark voted against it, while Germany and Austria abstained. Analysts say it's clear there will never be an EU-wide minimum wage. Pay systems and economies vary greatly. For example, currently, the minimum wage in Bulgaria is €312 a month. In Luxembourg, it is €2,142. Employers are afraid to invest at present due to all of the unknowns surrounding COVID-19, high energy prices and political uncertainty in some EU nations.
Businesses want certainty. They can't have certainty, but they would like a bit of predictability for investment reasons in particular. And they don't have that at the moment because of these issues that you just mentioned. And they don't know what's around the corner.
Disaster is around the corner for the EU project, experts warn, if the bloc's leaders continue in their failure to deliver greater social justice. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, today we're going to continue our discussion about Imam Khomeini's views on the armed forces. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes in his testament, "In Iran, where this miracle of the age, the Islamic Revolution, was worked by the people, the committed armed forces and the pure and patriotic commanders had a significant share. And today, as Saddam's war that has been imposed by the order and support of America and other superpowers has faced the political and military defeat by the invading Ba'athist army and its powerful supporters and their lackeys, it is again the armed forces and the new law enforcement forces, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and popular forces, who created this great honor in the front with the unsparing support of the nation. They made Iran proud, and the internal mischief and plots that had been mobilized by the puppets affiliated to the East and the West to overthrow the Islamic Republic were thwarted by the able hands of the younger generation of the Islamic Revolutionary Committees, the Basij Volunteer Forces, the police, with the help of the brave people. It is the same dear selfness, younger generation, who stay awake at night so that their families rest calmly. May God bless them." The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, continues, "I recommend kindly to all armed forces, in the end of the life of this world, just as they have been loyal, to be firmly loyal to Islam, which is the only religion of independence and freedom, and Almighty God has invited all to the lofty human status with its light of guidance. It is Islam that rescues you, your country, and your nation from the strain of dependence and affiliation to the powers who do not want you except for their slavery, and keep your dear country and nation backward and the consumption market and under the shameful oppression. Prefer noble human life, even with problems, to the shameful life of slavery of foreigners, even if it is with animal welfare." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "My brotherly recommendation in the final steps of my life to the armed forces generally is that, O dear ones, who love Islam and continue self-sacrifice in the France and all over the country with the love of meeting God, be vigilant and alert as the political players and the West-toxicated and East-toxicated professional politicians and stealthy, mysterious hands have focused the sharp weapon of treachery and crime from every side towards you, dear ones, more than any other group, and they want to exploit your dear ones who have made the revolution victorious and revived Islam with your sacrifices to topple the Islamic Republic. And they want to separate you from Islam, and they want you to separate from the nation, and they don't want you to serve the country, and they want to throw you in the lap of one of the two world-devouring powers, and they want to nullify your efforts and sacrifices by political deception, tricks, in the Islamic and national form." Imam Khomeini then refers to the backwardness of Iran, saying, "After this, much of artificial backwardness to the great industries of the foreign countries, our need is an undeniable reality. This does not mean that we should be dependent on one of the superpowers in the advanced sciences. The government and the army should make effort to send committed students to the countries which have great advanced industries, while they're not colonialists and exploiters. and they should refrain from sending the students to America and the Soviet Union and other countries which are in the direction of these two poles. Perhaps, God willing, one day will come that these two powers will come to their senses and march in the path of humanity and humanitarianism and respect other people's rights. Or, God willing, the downtrodden of the world and the vigilant nations and committed Muslims will put them in their places. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "Know that as long as you extend your hand to others in advanced industries and spend your life in begging, the power of innovation and advancement in inventions would not flourish within you. And you saw clearly that in this short period after the economic sanctions, those who considered themselves unable to make anything and were disappointed of driving factories, put their thoughts into action and met many needs of the army and factories themselves. And this war, the economic sanction and expulsion of the foreign experts, were a divine gift, which we were negligent of. Now, if the government and the army sanctioned the goods of the world devourers and increased their effort in the way of innovation, it is hoped that the country will be self-sufficient and will be saved from begging the enemy." The late Imam Khomeini continued by saying, "We saw that many factories and advanced tools like aircrafts and other industrialized goods, which were not thought to be started by Iranian specialists, and all hands were extended towards the West and the East so that their specialists would start them. As a result of the economic sanction and the imposed war, our dear young people have made the needed parts and supplied them in lower prices, and have proved that we can if we want to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
simple question.
Who's really responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? The recent drowning of at least 27 migrants has led to renewed calls for a new approach to the ongoing crisis caused by those trying to start a new life in the United Kingdom. While British government officials claim it is on track to fix the broken asylum system, legislation has been criticised for making it harder for those arriving by boat to claim asylum in Britain. Those who speak for refugees even say the new proposals are actually cruel.
There's a pattern to the problem. A large proportion of these migrants come from Iraq, Syria and Afghanistan, all countries torn apart by conflict supported or even started by Anglo-American military escapades. Furthermore, while the UN Refugee Agency says deaths can be avoided with coordinated action, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson and French President Emmanuel Macron have fallen out after the French president objected to Mr. Johnson's accusations that France has not done enough to stop migrants crossing the Channel. The impact of these political and military conflicts has turned out to be lethal. War and conflict disrupt countries and entire regions, forcing migrants to flee. In their desperate efforts to start a new life, some pay traffickers large sums to assist them in their efforts to cross the Channel to England. This leads to illegal immigration, increasing tensions between France and the United Kingdom, and deaths in the sea, while France and Britain blame each other for the migration issue and the human toll of those who drown.
To what extent is the UK responsible for the deaths of migrants in the English Channel? And who should be creating a new place for people to live after escaping from war-torn conflicts in which the United Kingdom plays a part? Simple questions with important answers. And we begin our inquiry with a straightforward and direct question. What does the public think of the deaths of 27 migrants who drowned while trying to cross the Channel? We put that to the public here in London. This is what they told us.
A boat which is about the size as that one that goes up and down the river here, the small one. 27 people were on it and it capsized and they drowned this last week. Yeah, and they just drowned and their bodies were washed up on the shore. Yeah.
It's so sad to hear that. Yeah, I mean, things like that should not be happening in the future, of course.
It's an absolute tragedy, and I just wish that there were actually legal safe routes for people to get to Britain in order to claim refugee status.
The way that we talk about, you know, helping people and things like foreign aid, but when there's real issues like people trying to escape persecution, I think it's shameful that the government, you know, practically ignores or tries to deflect the problem.
I mean, it's just a shame, really, isn't it? I mean, it's upsetting when anyone dies, let alone migrants. I mean, there's the whole... I'm sure an overwhelming majority are just trying to escape what can be just explained nothing short of an absolute travesty.
Sad and disappointed.
I don't think that's very nice to hear at all.
They have family, they have mother, father, sons, daughter, and I think we or the government need to pay the attention in that case.
I think it's a terrible tragedy. I don't think anyone deserves to die when trying to gain freedom and have the rights that we should all be given as human beings upon this earth.
Well, obviously, wasted life is always a tragedy, but it would not happen if people didn't get on broken lilos and try to cross the busiest waterway in the world in treacherous weather.
Horrific, and why don't we have a secure way whereby these people fleeing from Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria are able to come to this country? I think we've opened the doors to, is it 3 million from Hong Kong? Why can't we find a humane, civilised way of helping these people?
It's very sad. It's sad that they have to move, like, come over here and try and find, like, obviously living over here. Like, it's sad that they have to do that, like, rather risk their life than just trying to find a better life where they actually are. I don't know, it's quite sad.
French government is responsible for us because that's their border.
and then the British government should take in care of their English waters or English Channel to control the border. I think nobody should risk their life for better life.
It's terrible. It shouldn't have never happened in the first place. I mean, they should just have safe passage to prevent this to start with.
Firstly, I suppose, used the word tragic, and it is a tragedy. Obviously, I think everybody can be completely sympathetic to the situation. And, yeah, of course, I think everybody was greatly saddened by the situation, considering there were children involved as well, which makes it even worse.
Many are refugees from conflicts fought by Britain, including in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other Middle Eastern countries. In the public's view, what responsibility does the UK have for these deaths?
I think we have a responsibility to provide safe passage for people to come here to attempt to claim refugee status. If we feel that we have the right to go and intervene in different ways around the world, then we have the responsibility to kind of follow up the results of that, I think.
Oh, we have massive responsibility. You know, it's anything that, you know, is initiated or guns that we sell to different parties in these conflicts is entirely, you know, the British government's responsibility to do something about it.
There's a very, very valid argument to make that to a certain extent, intervention in certain countries has worsened political situations. I mean, the arguable thing, you know, you can look at situations like maybe Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan is a very good one, I think.
I think we're responsible if we're involved in the conflict, but we're also responsible as a better off country to help people who are not safe.
It's hard to pinpoint the exact responsibility if the conflict that they're running from is caused by the UK or at least contributed to by the UK. There's definitely some responsibility there, in my opinion anyway.
Well, this should be something that maybe the governments of the world should look at, and those of us who have more to give should be able to give and allow safe haven for these people.
I think we do have some responsibility for taking our fair share of refugees from conflicts that we've had a part in.
They're mainly refugees from countries which have internal problems, and that's why there was influence from the British. And there are a number of countries that they could have stopped in along the way if they truly wanted somewhere that was just safer than where they came from.
These crossings are a consequence of us so-called global Britain meddling around in the Middle East, so we have a lot of responsibility.
I don't really know who to blame, but I'm pretty sure both sides should be responsible, like both France and the Britain part. Because is there a kind of shared channel, I guess? So,
there's some implicit responsibility because, you know, we've armed these countries, we've been involved militarily, and we haven't supported some of the kind of the transportation of the immigrants in the first place that were suffering in these countries.
That's a very loaded question. I think, obviously, they've travelled many miles to get to the UK. Clearly, I think there's a lot of discussion about being housed in the first port of call of whichever country they go to. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. I'm not an expert in that situation, but I guess if they do get to the UK, they're entitled to a hearing. They're entitled to the civil liberties, and obviously they're entitled to actually put their case forward. And that's the problem. I don't think they do get that. And perhaps the UK needs to have a rethink on that point.
Yes, some days ago, also, I heard about the problem in Afghanistan. I think that's something that is impossible to think in the 25... siglo? Century.
French police have been seen to watch on as many refugees board boats to cross the Channel. What do people here in Britain think of the French allowing migrants to make these hazardous crossings?
The French police have watched on. They've been filmed watching on while the traffickers send the boats across. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's difficult because if they... I don't know, that's a tough one. Because if they stop them, then they stop them being able to try and find somewhere safer. But at the same time, it's not a safe journey either. But I don't know, that's a tough one.
From a legal perspective, it very well could be justified. From my opinion, that doesn't come across as right.
Yeah, I wish that there was closer and better tempered and more even collaboration between Britain and France and between Britain and the rest of the EU. over this, to be fair. It's obviously not ideal that people are being allowed to launch themselves into small, unsafe boats into the channel. We've seen the result of that this year, so I wish that that wasn't happening.
If we start the war, obviously we should be taking responsibility for it. So, I mean, yeah.
The entire international community needs to take some responsibility and work together, like I say, to try and find a solution.
If you're seeing somebody getting on a boat that you know is probably not going to make it, I mean, in my opinion, I would be saying, don't make that crossing.
I think it's a responsibility of the French government.
Didn't see them to know if that's true or not. If it is, then they should be held accountable, but I haven't seen any evidence either way on that.
A very complex issue, I think. It's wrong of them to not intervene, although there's always circumstances around everything. But I think there's always a duty of care to people, no matter who or where they come from.
I can't understand how we haven't taken back control from the French police.
I think that's part of the reason why they want to come over here, because they're just not getting looked after very well, clearly, either. If they're getting allowed to get on the boats, causing tragedies, and they're allowing it to happen. We're trying to stop it, and they're allowing it to happen and allowing them to come while we're trying to stop.
I think British government, to be honest, because if you get involved in someone else's business, then there is always the consequences, so you have to face the consequences.
Basically, it's wherever they seek in, whichever country they look at to find asylum, that's where they should be housed in the first place.
I think what I probably would like to say, you wouldn't want to repeat, but I think that's absolutely disgusting. Clearly, if it's on the shores of the UK, we would expect the police to do their duty, and I think the same thing should apply to the French police.
The statistics underline the size of the issue and how little Britain is really doing to fix it. The Home Office plans to accept 5,000 people in the first year of the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, and up to 20,000 more afterwards. However, by late November 2021 alone, it is estimated that during this year, over 26,000 people, many from Afghanistan, had already arrived in small boats after crossing the channel illegally. Yet the Afghan conflict, in which the UK played a central role, generated 2.5 million refugees, of whom 2.2 million live in Iran and Pakistan, showing how small the UK's contribution is to fixing the problem it helped cause. Who should be held responsible for finding new homes for refugees escaping conflicts fought by Britain?
I think a lot of responsibility therefore comes onto the government to make sure that we can give safe passage to these refugees and we can allow them in and look after them, as the conflict is our fault.
I believe they should have handled the issue like in a more precise manner.
Just because that's the country they went in first doesn't mean that country has equal responsibility for them being a refugee in the first place.
We're partly responsible, and countries should work together. Unfortunately, we seem to be global Britain going it alone, but we should work, like with the health crisis on COVID, countries should work together to solve these problems, be it climate change, refugees. It's a shame that we don't have anyone with any diplomatic skills from Lord Frost, Rab, Priti Patel, Boris, to make sure we are responsible global citizens.
It should be a shared effort between more governments. I'd say Britain, France, and whoever participated in those wars. That would seem fair to me.
Allow them to make the crossing. Letting people make something that's unsafe, where they could possibly lose their lives, is almost like a criminal act. They're complicit in the deaths, in a way, by letting that happen. Yeah.
Well, again, I think it's down to probably every country to do their part. And we hear all the figures on the media. You never know whether you're hearing the right figures or not. Fairly obviously, I think other countries in Europe probably have taken more than the UK, and possibly the UK need to rethink their policy in that respect.
Who's actually responsible for rehousing people who've been victims of conflict that Britain itself has led or been involved?
I think if people have refugee status in Britain, then Britain is responsible for rehousing them. We shouldn't forget that Britain has, I think, around about 1% of the world's refugees here. We have a tiny, tiny percentage of the world's refugees. And if we want to see ourselves as global Britain, as a country that has a role on the global stage, then we need to step up and take responsibility for some of this.
I would not like to comment on that, yeah, but these things should not be happen. I mean, if they are watching it, they should have stopped it, of course.
I don't want to just pile blame onto my own government. It's obviously the responsibility of all governments to try and find a solution for these people.
But it is our responsibility as humans, as common man, to account for one another. So not just the government, but we all, as a collective, need to step up and do something about it.
My opinion is, rather than trying to figure out exactly who is responsible, is that if you feel you can do something, and as a country, if we feel we can do something, then we just should.
What is the public's advice to the British government about refugees who risk death in the process of trying to cross the channel?
I think these practices should be stopped. I mean, force measures should be taken to stop it, because if the people are trying to cross the channel, they can lose their lives. So, yeah, of course.
My advice to government would be to work with people, with our friends and colleagues in the EU, to step up and to act more humanely, to give people safe passage routes.
If the government wants to, you know, be re-elected, they need to take action and do something about it.
There are plenty of people in the country who would want to help. It's just reaching out and maybe putting together a system where people who can help and can provide housing, or even if it's just temporary. You know, there's a lot of people with spare bedrooms.
Everybody knows it's an issue, and it's been an issue for quite some time. My advice would be stop ignoring it. Do something.
Let's try and find a way where they don't have to risk death, and we can help them if it is that we're responsible.
Oh, I think, the Britain can help people who are homeless to find homes and so on.
I would say it's a very complex situation, but human life has to be saved amongst anything else. But I think rather than spending so much time trying to dissuade people from crossing, we should look at the reason why the people are going in the first place.
Work with other countries in a diplomatic manner to find a solution.
Should be able to give them set boats and, you know, better like accommodation to come over on, rather than just a dinghy that's probably going to sink halfway across. Like, we've got the boats, we've got like all the lifeguards and everything. We could be helping save more than anything, do you know what I mean? We have lifeguards that swim the channels on a night time to make sure everything's all good, so we could be making things a lot safer, and communication with the other governments as well is even better. Like,
it doesn't matter what their, like, what country they came from, but their life matters, so they should be taken care of. They should have been taken care of.
Not all the immigrants are genuine immigrants. Most of them, they are economic immigrants. So finding ways to support them in their own country so they don't have to cross the borders. First place, if they have come over risking their life, then find the ways to settle them.
Create a safe passage. That's all we need, is a safe passage. They shouldn't be risking their lives in the first place. Otherwise, they are complicit in what's happening.
Again, I think we need to put something into place, a more meaningful policy in place to give these people a chance to have their story heard, to have their situation checked.
The 27 migrants who drowned in the English Channel as they tried unsuccessfully to reach British shores made the headlines. These fatalities also provoked a bitter war of words between British and French politicians after UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson attacked French authorities and, by implication, the French President himself, Emmanuel Macron, for failing to prevent the crossings. Many make these dangerous journeys because of the impact of British conflicts on their homelands. A number of observers now believe that Britain must accept responsibility for causing much of the migrant problem. It seems a tragic irony that after travelling thousands of perilous kilometres from their war-torn homelands, desperate migrants seeking a new life drown within sight of the very country that turned them into refugees.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.